Now, it's my privilege to be here because this is a delightful centre, and I'm quite sure that a lot of people are going to make really creative use of it. Now, this question, what are we living for? It's not an easy question to answer, and we're going to look at some of the partial answers that people give. But there is a really big answer that will gradually work up to you, that's worth thinking about. I'm not going to say it's the final answer, but it's really worth pondering. First of all of us are born into life as a complete, organic, psycho-spiritual whole. We are a totality when we're born. And we're born with a higher part, which is the heavenly part, and we're born with a lower part, which is the earthly part. The first verse in Genesis, "In the beginning God created heaven and earth," is a description of our coming into existence. Swedenborg makes this very clear in the Arcana Celestia. And so we have this situation, that we're born... Now, I hope I can get these out. Is there some catch to these? Oh, now we're right. Here we are as a total individual, and we're born as a wholeness. You never see bits and pieces of babies coming out when they're born. Nothing is assembled as in a factory assembly line. We're complete and total. But we do have these functional divisions inside us. We have this little heaven, and we have this little earth. Now, of course, the heavenly part responds to spiritual, celestial, and divine impulses. The earthly part responds to everything that comes from this physical earth, from the physical planets around us, from the physical sun, from the physical galaxies. Now, the interesting part is, from the very moment that we're born, we are then subject to an infinite number of impacts from the world. The world begins to press upon us straight away. I remember seeing my first daughter born, and the instant that she was born, she was held up, and the eyes were just staring at this astonishing world. Now, that's what happens. It is the outer world that acts upon us from the moment we're born to the moment that we die. So if we live for, shall we say, 70, 80 or 90 years, we have billions and billions and billions of impacts, sounds, sights, aromas, touches and so on, impinging upon us continually. There is no getting away from it. We can't just escape to a quiet spot where there are no experiences and impressions reaching us. Now, as a result of this continual bombardment of impressions and stimuli from the world, internally we begin to respond and react to these things. We can't help doing it. If there is a sound, we turn our head in the direction of the sound. If there is an aroma, we start sniffing to locate its source. We are responding to everything that's taking place. Of course, the very obvious stimuli, such as a conversation or sitting watching a TV show or a movie, we are aware of that taking place, but we forget about all the subliminal stimuli. Supposing we're in a theatre watching a movie, we're aware of the movie, but if somebody starts whispering next to us, that becomes another little irritation. Somebody opens a box of chocolates down the road, that's a further irritation. Somebody drops Jaffas on the floor and they just roll and drop, that's yet another irritation to us, because the world is impinging upon us and our emotions begin to react. So we respond not only intelligently to the stimuli that are impinging upon us, but we often react with emotions, with moods, with sentiments, and with a very great mixture of feelings. Over a period of some years, a child becomes a complex mass of intellectual abilities to understand certain things that are taking place in the world, but there are also these emotional reactions, which may be of rage or jealousy. If a child is just one of several siblings and the others get some sort of favours, the one left out feels that its nose is out of joint, and it may put on an act, it may simply go and sulk, it may hit out at its brothers and sisters. All of these are reactions against what is happening in the outside world. Now, the point I'm trying to drive at is this. We become so involved in our interactions with the world that we forget all about this part of ourselves. It's not in our consciousness at all. Our consciousness becomes centered in this region where we are constantly seeing, hearing, and sensing things, and we are reacting and responding. Now, everybody is like this. We can't help it, but we are materialists. Now, we may not like the idea of it, but boy, we are materialists. Try and do without your car. Try and do without your home. Try and do without your clothes. Try and do without all the things that you own. Say, it doesn't matter. I'm just going to walk naked down the street. I'm going to eat grass leaves and so on. I don't want to own anything. Dissociate myself from mankind. We can't do it. We even have to drink water. We have to get food. We have to breathe the physical air around us. By nature, we are driven into this materialistic mode of life. It's a necessary interaction for the sake of keeping alive this external organic instrument that enables us to become connected with this world so that we can gather experience and energy from this world. But we become so involved with the things of the world that we do forget about this. All of this passes into our unconscious. The unconscious includes everything that we're not directly conscious of. I know in psychology people think of the unconscious as all the nasty thoughts and the skeletons in the closet that we push down. Well, in Freud's system, that's the case. But in more modern psychology, the unconscious is immense. It's everything we're not conscious of. If we're not conscious of God, then in a sense, God is in our unconscious. So we have a very vast unconscious. We're unaware of the nature of our own life. And we just live in this thin little veil of consciousness with all of its reactions that bind us to the world. And we are bound to the things of the world in a most extraordinary way. Now let us take our wristwatches. Many people wear wristwatches. Now if for some reason you have to leave your watch in the jewels to be repaired, new batteries put in, you are without it for a few days, you'll find yourself doing this. And it's quite a crazy thing to pull your sleeve up and there's just a bare wrist. Onlookers think that you're looking for fleas or pimples or something like that, you see. And we feel foolish in doing it. But we get into the habit of depending upon that little artificial gadget just to know what the particular time is. Now that's only one trivial thing, but we are bound to it. And that attachment, it's an emotional attitude, it's called identification. Identification is the downfall of human beings. We all identify with things. We identify with the things that we own. If you buy a brand new table and it gets a scratch on it, you feel very upset. You may even feel hurt. If you get a scratch on the side of a new car, that's really bad. It's enough to put you in hospital for a couple of days. The agony of it. Now that is identification. We make ourselves become one with the things that we own, the things of which we're proud. Now it's one thing to sensibly use our possessions, but it's another thing to immerse ourselves in those objects so that they count more than anything else. That's the habit of identification. In addition to these habits of identification, and by the way, this is only a side note, but it's a very potent one. How many identifications do you have? Don't answer now, but just think about it sometime. We have an extraordinary number. And part of our work upon ourselves, which Swedenborg is always urging people to carry out, is to see what's taking place inside and learn to break the unnecessary identifications. But we have this troublesome set of emotional reactions inside. These reactions attract us in certain directions, they repel us from other things and from other people. And out of all this mass of emotionalism, by hook or by crook, most of us somehow begin to fashion for ourselves a kind of career. The important thing that we feel that we ought to be doing in life. Now some people from an early age, they want to be a nurse or a doctor or they want to be a gardener or something like that. They're pretty clear about the career they'd like to follow. Other people haven't a clue. And I've known of people to go to law school and stick it in law school for 18 months before they've said, this isn't for me. I can't tolerate this barren sort of life, because they saw it that way. And so they drop out, and it takes them a long time before they can hit upon a suitable career. Now, the career that a person follows is very, very often their meaning of life. Because many people become devoted to their trade, their profession, their calling. They love doing their work. They may even become workaholics, and they find complete fulfillment in what they're doing. Some people enter the healing professions. Other people enter teaching professions. Other people like to explore things scientifically. Others like to write or paint or generate music. Whatever we do, it's an emotional choice. We feel it's the right thing for us. Whether it is really the right thing for us or not is a different matter, but people follow what their feelings indicate. If those feelings are mixed up, then we tend to get into the wrong calling, and that sometimes is very sad. There used to be a professor of medicine in Queensland University, and he was a very good medical man, an excellent medical man, but he hated it like poison. His parents and his various uncles and aunts were all medical practitioners, and they said, come on, you've got to go into the profession. And so he faithfully followed their indications. But it wasn't his choice. He wanted to be an engineer. Now, when he'd made enough money, he built below his house, because many of the Brisbane houses were on those wonderful stilts. And beneath his stilted house, he built a marvellous engineering workshop. When his last lecture for the day was over, he would race home into overalls and be with his drilling machines, his milling machines, his lathes and so on, doing jobbing work, subcontracting work for various engineering firms in the district. He loved it. Well, you see, what one truly loves inside, that's the calling to follow. But many people don't have the chance to do that. They're talked into following careers that they're not really suited for. And so there is much discontent. Nevertheless, a person in a calling says, well, I've got a family to look after, I've got responsibilities, I'll just have to keep doing this job. And so that becomes their life. So career is very often equated with the life of the person. Now, is your life wrapped up totally in your work, in your calling? Does everything that has any meaning at all circulate totally around your work? These are questions that we have to put to ourselves, because, as I said earlier, Swedenborg insists that we examine ourselves. Self-examination is prior to any change or any transformation that can possibly take place. And if we wish to get something to know something about the heaven inside us, we have to see how involved we are in this part of ourselves. Now, when the question is put to people, what are you living for, the most extraordinary answers come out. I started these questions 40 years ago, and I started to write down the answers. After a while, I began to stop writing the answers down. Some were absolutely ridiculous. But a typical series of responses are as follows. What are you living for? You say to one person, and that person will respond. I'm living for my children. I want to give my children a fair go in life. I want them to have security. All right, that's one person's response. You say to another person, what are you living for? Well, to make money, to be a success, to be secure, to have security in my old age. Fair enough. Yet another person will say, I want to rise to the top. I want to be top dog. Now, there's no embarrassment about it. They are just determined to be at the top of their profession or the top of the firm that they work for, or whatever it may be. Another person will say, don't know. That's a very, very common answer. Yet another person will say, I want to help mankind. Another will say, I would like to heal sick people, or I'd like to inspire people. Those last two or three responses are more noble than some of the early ones. But they're still not the complete answer. They're only partial expressions of what people understand by what they're living for. They don't know. If we wish to understand what we're living for, first of all, we have to take a very big view of this universe in which we live. See, most people live in a very small circumscribed area. Their home is there,
their place of work is there, the shops are there, and it's usually a movement backwards and forwards to and from the place of work and then down to the shops occasionally and back home. And this is, we're like ants. We just follow those little trails when we meet one another in the street. Ants tuck their antennae together, we just say good day. But it's on a similar pattern. And once we see how small and circumscribed our average daily activities are, it becomes rather horrifying. We're moving in very, very small circles. We have to get a much larger view of things. Now, supposing we take a look at the universe as a whole and try to see, in a symbolic way, something of its structure. Now, this sort of scheme is very well known in the East, where the structure of the universe has been represented by various layers and levels. And it goes something like this. At the very top we have the Absolute. Now that's just a neutral term for the divinity, for the uni-being creator, for the Lord God. It's just a neutral term. And many people of a scientific disposition, they don't like the word God. It's funny how they'll react to it, but they'll accept the word Absolute. People are absolutely strange. Now the divine, it creates from itself all possibilities. Everything that could possibly come into existence is generated within the divine and begins to proceed from the divine. So we'll say that the next level is all possible worlds. And that in itself is an enormous concept. If we say to ourselves, well, what does that mean? Is this the only universe that God's ever created? We have to think about these things. Unless we think, we'll never get to know anything. Now, within all these possible worlds, we live in this particular universe. And in this particular universe, we live within the Milky Way, which contains about 100,000 million suns or stars. So we have our galaxy, or our Milky Way. That's our bigger environment. Now, of those 100,000 million suns, our own sun is the nearest one to us. It's our nearest star. So the sun comes very close to us. But the sun is surrounded by this family of planets moving in their orbits. So we have the planetary system. And of those planets, the one that interests us because we live here is the Earth itself. And then the Earth itself has its own little satellite, the Moon, moving around it. Now, you can't go any further than that. There is nothing moving around the Moon. So the ray of creation, as it's called, in this part of the universe stops with the Moon. In other parts of the universe, the system may go on several more steps. But we can only be concerned with this part of the universe, the Earth, where we live. Now we begin to see that there are certain things below us, which is the Moon. It's a lesser body than is the Earth. Above us there are much vaster things, and it's rather hard for us to form any sort of relationship with them. If we stand out on a clear evening and look at the Milky Way, it's just a maze of stars, and it's very hard to feel a personal connection with them. Very difficult. But we need to have some sort of relationship between ourselves, because we are dwellers on the earth, and the rest of the universe. We are born into this universe. We belong to it. And so we're going to reconstruct this diagram in another way to show a more intimate connection. So realizing that that is the scheme that we're following, we're now going to draw seven concentric circles. That will be the Moon. The next circle will be the Earth. Then we shall have the planetary system, the Sun, the galaxy, all possible worlds, and embracing the whole lot is the Absolute or the Divine. Now this may seem a strange way of locating things. If we take this literally, we say, well, how can the Moon be inside the Earth? The Earth isn't hollow. And how can the Earth be inside the Sun? Because the Sun isn't hollow. We say that's a ridiculous way of representing things. That's only an appearance. And you know, Swedenborg warns against being taken in by appearances. You have to go behind appearances to see the reality. that stands there. Appearances are only symbolic representations. The moon exists within the gravitational sphere of the Earth. The Earth exists within the gravitational sphere of the planets, because it's pulled and pushed by the gravitational fields of other planets, and the planets, they exist within the huge gravitational field of the Sun. The Sun in turn is held in place by all the gravitational and cosmic energies of the galaxy. The galaxy is held in place by its enormous attractions with the billions of other galaxies in the universe. And everything is contained within the incomparable, infinite wholeness of the divine. That makes the universe a vast, interconnected oneness. Just as we are born into life as whole beings, so the universe as a creation is one complex yet harmonious work of the uni-being creator, who embraces the lot and easily controls the lot, because from every point of the divine influences of all kinds pass to every level and holds the whole thing together and saturates it through and through with value, meaning, purpose and function. Now let's count out the moon and the earth. That's where we live. Now if we can see ourselves as being enveloped by these various energy fields, if we can see ourselves being touched and influenced by, shall we say, the gravitation of the planets around us and the sun and the luminous energy or the sunlight that comes from the sun, if we can somehow feel that even the galaxy itself in some subtle way touches us, and if we can also realize that the divine touches us in a very special way, enabling us to have this incredible energy called life flowing through us, then we begin to get a sense of kinship with everything around us. We are a point of consciousness in a vast system that's filled with creative energies. The divine has created this system for its own purposes. We are stuck in the middle of it, and we don't understand what that vast purpose is, but we have to try and sense what it's all about. We can never come to understand ourselves until we begin to see our connections with the vastness that surrounds us, the vastness that is within us. Now, to make things even more complicated, but at the same time more interesting, we have this situation. We know from ancient philosophy, and it's a thing that Swedenborg often quotes, human beings are a microcosm. We are a miniature universe. This is the macrocosm. And all the laws of the macrocosm are present in the microcosm. We, the microcosm, are in the midst of this system. And all the structures, all the laws, all the influences and potencies in that huge structure, in some form, are in us. We are a reflection, a manifestation, a bringing together in a very tight and highly condensed form and in a very sensitive form of all the laws and processes that hold the whole universe together. If we wish to discover something about the universe from the internal viewpoint, we can. If we know how to search, we can find it in ourselves by searching in the appropriate direction. When Swedenborg had his inner senses opened, he found that he was making tremendous journeys, which on the outside seemed to be great travels through the universe. But he was moving from one part of himself to another. And to move from there to there may take days, may take hours. This is a very strange idea, and yet it's the way things function. Everything that's been created in this universe in some form is represented in us. Learning to reach those representations in us can give us at least some insight into aspects of the universe and what they're all about. And once again, Swedenborg comes to our rescue. Whilst this may seem to be a vast mechanical system, it isn't. The universe in its appearance is one thing, and note that term, appearance. What it is internally is a quite different thing. Through his laws of correspondences, Swedenborg tells us that every natural thing that exists, everything brought into creation, corresponds to the energies, the wisdom, the love, the consciousness, and all the creative processes that went into its making. So if from a higher level something is brought forth to manifest down here, that externally manifesting thing corresponds to all the energies and processes that brought it forth. That's the law of correspondence. The universe is a huge creation. Every point, every aspect of it corresponds to something in the divine. That's what we must try to understand. We have to get an inside view of reality. But you see, we live in such a way that only our earth, only our outside is functioning. And try as we may, we can only keep on getting this outside view of things. Something is terribly incomplete in our lives. Even if we read the very best and most profound books on the subject, and there's no doubt about it, Swedenborg's writings, they are the most complete descriptions of higher states that have ever been produced. If you read through the Tibetan Book of the Dead, the Bardo Todol, you have only very generalized descriptions of spiritual states. If you read through the Egyptian Book of the Dead, again there are only general descriptions of hells and of heavenly states and celestial states, but they're very vague. Swedenborg is precise. He gives accurate, scientifically reported accounts of his observations which he noticed. So our views are always external views. We must learn how to develop an inside view of things. This is where we must translate teachings and doctrines and spiritual concepts into actual psycho-spiritual practices within ourselves. We have to make the process work within us. People say, oh, but Swedenborg was unique. He went through the process. Right, he was a man like the rest of us. We're all men on this earth. Whether we're male or female, we're all men in the eyes of God. We are created in exactly the same way that Swedenborg was created. And the things that are possible for Swedenborg are possible for us. Even the Lord said that when he was alive on the earth. If I be lifted up, all men shall be lifted up with me. Now that's the universal law, and we must understand it. So we have to make very great efforts to try to open up something within ourselves. Let's see how we can possibly go about this. Once again, the earthly part of ourselves and the heavenly, or the inner self, the spiritual self, which in so many people is in a more or less dormant sleeping state. It's not active. It does have some activity, but it doesn't intrude very much into the external life. Even very clever people only have the faintest stirrings. Now, we saw this only a couple of nights ago. On TV, Clive Robertson was interviewing Sir David Attenborough, the great explorer of nature, and he presents nature so very well. And he said to David Attenborough, what are your feelings about God after you've studied all these things? And Attenborough said, well, he said, by nature I'm an agnostic. He said, that's the way that I've always lived. He said, but the more I look into the details of nature, the more I feel myself drifting towards the divinity. And that's a very interesting thing. Something is just beginning to seep through. In some people there are big awakenings, as in Swedenborg, or some of the earlier mystics like Plotinus, even Plato, and Socrates in particular. He used to see these spiritual figures standing close by him, and he'd go into a trance state in a standing position, and he would see these spiritual figures, and he would listen to his spiritual demon speak to him, his guiding spirit. Many people throughout the ages have had this little contact with another life. Swedenborg went through something very big and very important, and repeatedly in his writings he says, if only people will concentrate, if only they'll pay attention, they can get this part of themselves open. The invitation is there all the time. But no, people would say, oh well, that was only Swedenborg, that's not for us, we'll just read what he's written. That's not good enough. How do we open this heavenly part? Swedenborg describes the method perfectly, as do esoteric schools all throughout the East. It's so simple that we say, can't possibly work this way. by striving with all of our might to seek and to sense the reality of God, to try and feel deep down within ourselves that God is the fundamental reality, that God is this universal generative energy which produces not only a universe, not only all the forces in it, but sustains the whole thing in functional harmony, generates all forms of life and maintains them in beautiful ecological order until we come along and muck it up, generates the incredible biochemical, physiological and general biological harmony within our body, gives our mind sensitivity so that we can think, explore, imagine, conceive all sorts of things and come to an understanding of ourselves. To realize that the divine is the source of all that, to realize that the divine is constantly sending impulses, outpourings, to try and arouse us, to try and awaken us into our true position in reality so that we'll begin to make something of ourselves. We must understand that, because unless we understand its possibility, we'll never open ourselves to it. We must see the divine has a redeeming aspect, a regenerative aspect. And if we can develop a genuine affection for the divine, because we begin to perceive and understand these things, it is that affection which opens up something to our higher part, and it opens our higher part up to the divine, so that there is a reciprocal interplay takes place. That is the method, but we have to work at it, and we have to work at it with great sincerity. The earthly part, it only uses words and terms to express its ideas. All that the external part of us knows relates to the outside world. We are experts in handling the things of the outside world, whether it's through chemistry or engineering or botany or whatever. We are experts. We can take matter and we can manipulate the various forms of matter in incredible and quite wonderful ways. And that's the performance of uses. But that's all we know about this little chunk of the universe. We know it from the external applications. We cannot use these words and terms and this limited understanding to comprehend anything above us. Everything above us becomes transpersonal. It's beyond our personal experience. And whilst our knowledge may be very detailed and very complex, it's useless in trying to deal with, contain, explain, or influence in any way at all these higher energies, because these are finer energies. At this physical level, we find that we have coarse energies. These energies that we function with in everyday life, they're quite coarse. Look at the heaviness and the ugliness of just plain anger. That's a very coarse energy. And compare that with a state of sweet lovingness expressed to a newborn babe. That's a much finer energy. It's coming up a little closer to this higher part of ourselves. But this higher part, it works with ultra-fine energy. And the language of our external coarse energy life cannot possibly cope with these ultra-fine states. But something in us has to develop this sincerity of affection, and it must express a willingness to surrender itself before the mightiness, the absolute vibrant living mightiness of the divine. Now, when that can be done, these doors open. It's the opening of these inner doors which is so important. Remember John of the Revelation. He heard this voice calling, and there was a door opened, and behold, he was transported into the Spirit. Those are the doors that we're talking about. They are externally seen as doors, but internally they are transitions to a finer state of being. This can happen to anybody. It can happen in a vision. It can happen in a dream even, because sometimes dreams are the stirring of quite deep and profound states within ourselves. Now, once those doors become open, then the divine is able to reach us with much more. But there's a certain rule and regulation applies here. We'll just clear some of this away to indicate how this rule works. It's very important. So if we have these doors or openings established, it means that the divine is able to enter us, but it can only enter so far. It can only come to what is its own. Now, this is a great spiritual law that Swedenborg repeatedly writes about. The divine will never come into what is not its own. If we have a thick, heavy personality down here, that's made up of all of our psychological responses, with many habits that we've acquired from mingling with the things of the outside world. It's impossible for the divine to step into that personality and straighten it up. There is nothing in that personality that is of the divine nature. If we have read spiritual teachings, and we've got within ourselves, shall we say, truths from the word, alright, some of those things can be receptacles. The divine can come unto what is its own, because those teachings came from the divine in the first place. But the divine cannot reach into our proprium, which is our ego. It cannot reach into all of our heavy, dense, thick and muddy emotions. It cannot get into all the stupid and stale and boring thoughts that we have inside. There is nothing of the divine in them. They are not receptacles for the divine. Part of our duty in life is to try and get within ourselves the things that come from God. They are vessels, they are receptacles. If we've got receptacles inside, then we can receive and store something which later we can draw upon and use for our spiritual growth. But the divine will only enter what is its own. This heavenly or spiritual part of ourselves, that belongs to God, because it contains ultra-fine substance that the divine has planted in us. That's the instrument whereby the divine can reach us. Now, over a long period of time, as there is a gradual infilling of this part of ourselves, and that can only be infilled, it can only be instructed by the divine, or truths taken from the word and from many of the indications of Swedenborg, etc., gradually this becomes functional. Gradually it may become stronger. When it becomes much stronger, then it can begin to exert an effect upon the levels below. This becomes very positive in its outlook, and also it acquires a great deal of consciousness. Instead of belonging to the unconscious, when we were so filled with this part of ourselves that we didn't bother about the higher spiritual part, the more the divine energy flows into us, the more consciousness we get, because consciousness is spiritual light, and it's carried in the form of truths into our inner being. As consciousness accumulates, so this higher consciousness in us is able to look down into our outer self, and it's able to see the mess that is there. There's a real mess down here, all sorts of squiggles and wriggling things mixed up with a lot of very useful data and information that serves us well in the world, and a lot of spiritual teachings that we've gathered from a variety of sources. It's a mixture. But this inner light of consciousness enables the inner self to begin working upon the outer self. And a struggle comes about. The outer self doesn't like being corrected. It begins to rebel. It begins to react. It reacts against various things in the world, and so it's going to react against higher things penetrating and seeing through its weaknesses. So a struggle takes place. Without that struggle, we cannot undergo transformation. The struggle has to take place so that this higher part of ourselves can gradually become strong and supreme. But it is just and it is fair. That's the important thing. The outer part of us is full of reactions, and there is a lot of injustice there. Even parents who love their children very dearly are sometimes quite unjust to them when they correct them when the children have done something that's either regarded as bad or they've broken something. Sometimes the emotional reactions of that loving parent can be very severe. So we don't always find justice, even in people who care very much for others. But this is just. It doesn't demand too much of this outer self. This outer self of ours is very feeble. That's why grown men cry in the movies sometimes. They're moved by some tender scene. Yet on the outside they're strong, they're tough, they're macho. But we are very frail on the inside. But we like to seem to the world to appear to be very tough and always up top with things. So gradually this catalytic effect takes place. Consciousness penetrates every part of our being. We start to see our faults and inadequacies. We see how identified we are, not only with the things around us, but we're identified with our own opinions and our attitudes. All these things we store up and think very highly of them. Especially when other people seek our opinion, we begin to feel that we must be very important if people ask us things. And so we start to value these opinions of ours very, very greatly, as though they are wondrous realities. They're not realities, they're only fleeting opinions. And they may be incorrect at that. So when we begin to see through the weaknesses, when we begin to see through these lies that we're telling ourselves that we're very, really very clever and very important people, gradually the outer self surrenders its authority. The ego begins to weaken. The personality begins to undergo changes. It softens a little. Now, as that catalytic action changes, the inner self actually re-educates the outer self. Over a very long period of time, we have to stress this long time period, the outer self begins to accept the things that come to us from above. And those things that come to us from above in turn come from God. So there's a kind of a chain reaction through the different levels of the universe. Gradually, this chaos and disorder can be replaced with a considerable degree of order. And then when the higher really penetrates the lower, and the lower begins to align its energies and its functions and processes with that which is coming from above, then we have a state of agreement between the inner self and the outer self. Our earth conforms to heaven, and harmony prevails. So this unification of our being, it does take a long time, but it's worth struggling for. We've now reached a starting point. Now this is a very important starting point, because if we can become functionally unified on the inside, then things that come from the divine, things that come from the spiritual and the celestial realms, begin to filter into us. So we find that becoming a more integrated, a more wholesome individual, all sorts of new influences come to us from the spiritual level, then from the higher celestial level, and also from the divine. And gradually we begin to see that there is a much bigger career that lies ahead of us than we'd ever contemplated before in our lives. Now let's try to understand this principle. The creativity of the divine is always restricted. Our minds don't see and don't understand very much, so we say, all right, God created the world. And we leave it at that. The divine, which has no boundary in any sense at all, although it personifies itself as that radiant figure of the Lord, the infinite is represented and flows through the figure of the Lord. But this infinite divine, it is creative in every conceivable direction. One of those directions happens to be in the universe in which we live. But the divine cannot restrict its infinity to any single formation. The divine is endlessly creative. You see, the divine is in the realm of the eternal. And that's a realm where there is no time. Absolutely no time. When a universe is developed, this is the world of flowing time. The world of change, of growth, duration, and decay. But the divine has an inexhaustible creativity which is not limited in any single direction. The universe is one of the manifestations of the divine. But it has other procedures. It has so many other things. And Swedenborg, if you read his writings very carefully, hints at this tremendous ongoing creativity. In fact, it's always a very good thing to say to ourselves once in a while, what is God doing at this moment? Some of you may have read a book called Meetings with Remarkable Men by Gurdjieff. Gurdjieff was a very interesting man who travelled through many countries of Asia, and he explored the spiritual systems. He lived in monasteries, he lived with Sufis, he carried out yoga systems. There was hardly an esoteric teaching he didn't explore. But as a boy, he would listen to his father and the bishop of the local cathedral talking together. And they would throw these questions at one another. What is God doing now? And the bishop would say, well, God is building little ladders so that people can climb into heaven. That sounds crazy. That after physical death, the person, as a fully awakened spirit, soul, or essence, moves out of the physical universe onto some of these, or one of these, rungs on that cosmic scale. So the unified individual may be high up, may have become celestial because of profound lovingness there. Coming close to the divine, that unified spirit is not going to just loll around with an electronic harp, sit on a jet-propelled cloud and just take life easily. That's a childish belief that so many people have, and even some scholarly people have roughly that sort of view, that after death, if you've lived correctly, then life is going to be perpetually peaceful. And yet God is the highest activity in the whole of reality. God, who is total activity, is not going to tolerate lazy bumpkins just loafing around doing nothing whilst he does everything. That would be an incorrigible situation. No, once the soul becomes unified, it becomes more active, becomes more dynamic. It feels the need to do. But we can only do when we're fully alive, when every energy from every level is reaching us, is flowing through. Then we have the capacity to do. Very often there is much we would like to do, but we don't have the energy or the know-how to do it. But if we become cleared of our internal psychological impediments, then gradually a very great integrated power operating through us holds us together in such a way as we can start to do what previously we could not do. In other words, we become more internally active than before. In the spiritual world, if we do reach a higher level, that activated soul is going to become involved in one or other of these outpourings that's coming from the divine. Paul once made a statement, "Know ye not that ye are co-workers together with God?" He was referring to something beyond our ordinary existence, of course. But a fully awakened, a fully cleansed and purified soul becomes useful to God. That's our cosmic duty. That's our cosmic obligation, to enter into all these other realms of creativity and ongoing expressiveness. God requires conscious souls for his purposes, not to loll around in beautiful heavens. Those are only descriptions of beautiful interior states. But we become more active than before. Our real work begins once we've reached that state. But we have to work very hard to attain that state so as to become of use to God. But to become a co-worker together with God means to receive into oneself those outgoing energies, to be guided and inspired to do the right things. And if one is an integrated person, one can do. God requires souls, but never demands of any one of us that we do this or we do that. If that were the case, we would be total puppets. But we're not puppets. The situation is something like this. We are sown into the world as seeds. And the parable of the sower has a lot to say about this. If those seeds are fortunate enough in germinating and growing appropriately by the assimilation of higher truths, then those seeds may become souls. And that's due to a joint action of the sincere efforts of the individual and the inflowing energies of the divine. It's a joint enterprise that a soul is formed. God is always hopeful that the seeds or essences sown into these organic bodies of ours will become souls, but never compels people to form a conscious soul. The invitation is always there. Be ye perfect. Now, perfect means to be thoroughly made. So there is the invitation to become a soul. The soul after physical death can become useful to God, because God has these multiple ongoing purposes. They don't stop with the creation of the universe. But God never compels anybody to become a helper in that sense. When we learn to see our cosmic duties, then, and only then, do we know what we're living for. You see, it takes a great deal to realize what our life is about. So when we ask the question, what are you living for? Does one have a huge cosmological view like this that sees the divine creativity going on without any end, because it's in a timeless realm, the eternal? The divine requires conscious souls to participate in that. Conscious souls gather together in what Swedenborg describes as the grand man. Other religions have described the grand man as well. In the Jainist religion, for example, the universe is thought of as a gigantic human figure. And when souls become perfected, they float up inside this and they form droplets, just like drops of vapor condensing on, shall we say, the top of a ceiling. So souls gather in the inside of this colossal cosmic figure. Other souls of a lesser nature will collect in the shoulders, others down in the feet, and so on. It's exactly the same idea as the grand man, but it's been understood by peoples from various ages, ever since people have been on this earth. So human souls of a high quality, they are going to assemble together. It's not just one person who fits in with the ongoing functions of God. It's whole communities, and that is intended to grow and become richer and richer and richer. Because for huge creative projects, we can describe them as such, myriads of conscious souls are required as the instrumental means through which the creativity, through which the communication of new knowledges and new wisdoms can be carried out. Swedenborg describes this participation in this ongoing process as these great gyres. Now, whenever you have curved lines anywhere, this indicates movement. Look at the tracks of a skier coming down a slope. They're never straight lines like that. They always follow curves. Instead of the way a river flows, it always follows curves. If you watch a person's footprints on wet grass, they'll always make little curves. When people take a shortcut from a street across a vacant allotment to the next street, there's always a slight curve in it. Curves are associated with movement. These gyres are great sweeping curves. They enable reconstructions in our psyche to take place, but they're also a preparation for participation in the ongoing functions of the divine. The divine is always doing something, is perpetually active. If we have the idea of entering into eternal rest and doing nothing, then we become so lazy we're not even going to push the daisies up. And so we become an abomination. Things which are neutral and stagnant and quite dead are useless to God. They're useless to everybody else. So with the growth of this active soul or this active spirit, we become contributors to the ongoing harmony of the whole scheme. Now, that's what we're really living for. Our external activities, our career, our trade, profession, whatever it is, that's very important to us. We have to develop outside skills. We have to be able to bring even some of our spiritual functions into play through our natural mind so as to be expressive. A person who is a painter, he has to draw upon spiritual inspiration so as to paint what he sees in vision. A person who inwardly hears a melody, like a Beethoven, he heard the whole symphony within himself, spiritually, then tried to communicate it through the musical script so that others would be able to hear and enjoy the melodies. In our external life, we must develop those faculties and skills. Indeed, what we do with our lives externally is really a preparation for our spiritual activities. If we can carry out our daily work faithfully, sincerely, or with delight, with a feeling of harmony and wholeness, and we're making a contributive service to those around us, then we are being faithful to our external life. If we're faithful in our external life, we can be faithful in the bigger and more responsible things of the Spirit. In a sense, we are tried and tested by the honesty and the integrity of our outside activities. So when people say, "What am I living for?" Well, I'm living because I want to do well in life. I wish to have a wife and a family. I wish to have a car of my own. But I'm prepared to work for it, and I'm prepared to wait for the big results. So when people make self-application and they do their work honestly, they're really preparing the ground for the coming of something else from a higher level into themselves. But when people say, "What am I living for?" Sex, man, sex, or booze, beautiful booze, that's all I'm after. When people have that sort of ideology, they're not living for anything at all. They're just living on a basis of pure organic sensation. Everything is centered within their own trivial little ego, and it would never occur to them to do something to help somebody else. If somebody falls over, bad luck, mate, pick yourself up and I'll just walk by. Or they might even kick you down again just to see you make an extra struggle with further pain added to your body. We've got lots of roughs and toughs in the world like that who've got no sensitivity and no feeling. They cannot grow a soul that's going to become a co-worker with God. We can only take into the spiritual world that which we have worked for in this life. By condensing within ourselves, through honest application, our efforts. If our efforts build up patterns of activity, if we build up within ourselves functions, and above all, if we bring all these forth as uses, then we are establishing a pattern that will never die. Those internal formations, they live on after us. But things which are only body-centered, such as getting drunk every day, or just looking for total sexual fulfillment, or just how much money that one can accumulate, those things are sense-based. And when we die, our spirit has to leave those things behind. But it means that a person who's just followed those trivial pursuits, they've never looked at, they don't even believe in such an internal thing as the essence or the soul. They've never invested in it. They've never developed it half a millimeter. They've got nothing to take back to God. Something is invested in us when we're born. It's like the parable of the talents, where the master gave to one man 10 talents and said, "Invest them," to another 5 talents, to another 2 talents, then 1. The man with 1 talent, he regarded the master as a Scrooge who was just out to earn profits without doing any labor himself. And so the money was taken away from him. He had not invested it. These talents are the skills and the powers the divine sows into us. And the beautiful part is that talents are different in each one of us. Some have the talent or capacity for mathematical reasoning, others for the translation of languages, others for doing clever scientific research, others for helping, serving, perhaps even in menial tasks. But what they do, they enjoy doing. And if we can get genuine enjoyment out of our work, and we feel that we're contributing something to the workings of the whole, then we have an inner sincerity. We are building uses within ourselves that remain not just in our body, but they settle into the deepest spiritual part of ourselves, and they live there forever. It becomes our own personal property forever. because it's what we've made intentionally. And if, when we look at our own little chunk of the world, shall I say, just our home or the place where we live, inside that region we have carpets to clean, we have dishes to wash, we have beds to make, we have all sorts of trivial tasks to do, these chores. And sometimes we shortcut them. You know, the dust under the carpet, the dirty dishes into a cupboard if visitors come and so on. We do all sorts of funny things. But if we take the view, right, this is a little arena of harmony. Now there's an interesting view to take of one's place. We say to oneself, this is an arena of harmony. The Divine has entrusted me with the task of maintaining this harmony, which is done through cleanliness, by keeping things in order. And even if I have to scrub that floor 300 times in a year, I'll probably have to do it to maintain the harmony, the cleanliness, and the sanctity of the place. If we make our living place or our working place a sacred area, a temenos, as it was called in ancient times, then we're going to see to it that we work quite willingly and quite hard to preserve that sanctified region that we're in charge of. It's our little part of creation we have to take care of. If we can bring ourselves to see that, then it means that all those tasks of bed making, washing the dishes, washing and hanging up the clothes, is something that we should enter into with vigor, with consciousness. And we do it intentionally. We don't do it just because it's there and has to be done. We say to ourselves, right, here's the task. Let's go about doing it. That change of attitude changes everything in us. It's a new orientation. But you'll find that this is a very interesting way of regarding your home or your workplace. It is an area of harmony. It is this temenos. It is a sacred area set apart. Many of the ancients set apart a temenos, either in a temple. Supposing you have a large temple, there's the building of the temple, and you have the grounds around the temple. Certain areas of the grounds were set aside for ceremonies, and people were not allowed to walk or do things on those areas unless it involved some sacred ceremony. Or a place like Stonehenge. The henge itself is a circular piece of ground with a ditch dug all around it. At one time, Stonehenge had a very deep ditch around it. And then the stones were placed to form that horseshoe shape. But it's in that temenos that sacred ceremonies were carried out. This was part of the ritualistic religion of the ancients. And then at nearby Avebury was a much bigger circle, enclosing about 26 acres, with a very deep ditch which was about 30 or 40 deep when it was first made. That area, which contained three stone circles, was also a temenos. And these people worked to keep that clean, to keep it tidy, to keep it sanctified. They worked at it. Now that's what we must do. If we can do this with the physical environment in which we live, then we can do likewise within our spirit. And that's our instrument of living on the inside. We can learn to keep this internal part of ourselves as neat, as orderly, and as tidy as the outer part. That we must do. Because if we let little dark patches arise, that can be a negative state. If we let dust accumulate, those can be small evils gradually gathering, which we don't notice. They might be jealousies. Might be too much gossip arising within us. And gossip is just as bad as resentment or jealousy. There may be all sorts of bric-a-brac that just begins to accumulate, making the mind look untidy and stopping it from thinking clearly. Watchfulness on the inside, the same as we apply watchfulness to our home environment, is a discipline that keeps our sacred internal temenos clean and pure. Now these are distinctive ways of working upon ourselves so as to prepare ourselves for that greater life. And that greater life is to participate in what the work of God is all about, which is an ongoing work without any end. And that is an enormous challenge to every one of us. Scientifically, we can't prove any of this. But science has nothing to do with the way that the Creator works. Einstein once noticed this. Einstein had spent all of his life trying to find a set of equations which would describe all the laws of physics, the so-called unified field theory. And on one occasion he was talking to a fellow mathematician. Einstein said, "I'm having an awful job integrating these equations. How is it that God just integrates empirically and we have to go through all the hard work trying to follow his steps?" Now see, here is a man who recognized that creation is much greater than anything that the human mind can turn out. We are privileged participants in an enormously vast scene that is so full of interest, that is so full of human concern, that's so full of human passions and thirsts and interests and visions and hopes and progressions, that none of us should ever live a dull and an uninteresting life. We have an infinity of things to move towards. We don't have to be egotistic about anything and say, well, if I do the right thing, God's going to pat me on the head and give me a specially coloured halo. That meritorious attitude, which many people throughout the world adopt, and even the Buddhists have it, they think that by accumulating merit that one can reach a higher heaven. They're not all like that, but many people believe in this merit and in their religious teachings. Work meritoriously, acquire merit. It's something like a negative karma. Karma is something that works against us, all the heavy stuff that we accumulate, and that's supposed to bring you back into all this cycle of rebirths. But acquiring merit is like a spiritual karma going in the right direction. The more merit you get, the higher you float in the universe. But that becomes abused. The ego imagines to itself it's doing meritorious things, and so it conceives that it's becoming very holy and very pure, and it's possibly going in the reverse direction. When we can abandon modes of thinking like that, and we say, we keep this clean and we keep this clean because we discover and we understand and we apply to ourselves the living truths which are given to us through this word, and those truths are eternal. If we learn to live by the truths, if we see the incredible detail that's in the truths, then those truths fitting together, they make that harmony become possible in our world and within ourselves. But if we allow false notions, false opinions, self-invented interpretations to creep in, then we begin to fill that space up inside until there is no room for truth. And many people do that. Many people cause their minds and their essences to become like garbage cans. They read prolifically. They'll read metaphysical theories, they'll read spiritualistic theories, they'll read Rosicrucian theories. You name the system, they've read all about it. They've got a colossal collection of data, and all this stuff is stored up in the inside, and they aren't even present inside themselves. They're like a garbage can which all the world's intellectual rubbish is there, but they're not in amongst it. There's no room even for their own selves to be there. We have to avoid that sort of thing. Sure, we have to read widely to try and find common laws, common principles, to find examples of truths that we know explained, rendered in detail. To see the same truth manifest in a variety of forms is very comforting. We find certain truths in Christianity or the Old Testament. We find that in esoteric Buddhism or tantricism or in yoga or Sufism, that the same truths are showing up. This is great. We see the universality of those truths, and so we become more confident in applying and using them. But many people just read for the sake of reading, and so they become intellectual garbage cans. We can't afford to be that. We have to keep emptying out the inside of ourselves to make room for life itself to flow in. And life, of course, is the energy of the divine. This very life that flows through us every day. Again, here is something we can do. As that life is present in us, we can say, what is this mysterious thing that we call life? When we try to explain it, we are defeated, because we don't find it in the property of chemical molecules. We don't find it as an exchange of entropy with the environment. There is nothing that we can say physically, thermodynamically, mathematically, or chemically that will explain this experience of life. Life is within us the active essence of divine being. It is the activity of the divine flowing through us. It comes from another level, comes from another source. And therefore we have to try and discover how it enters us, how it becomes personal to us. The more we explore these states, the more we either relax and try to see what's taking place, or engage in the middle of busy activity, we say, how is it that I'm energized to do this? How is it my limbs can coordinate and I don't even have to think how to do it? The more we explore these mysteries and see for ourselves the incredible nature of life, so we begin to appreciate an enormous intelligence and wisdom and love that's working through each one of us. In a very real sense, each one of us is a living miracle. When scientists try to explain our bodies, they get a whole lot of bones. Some are Neanderthal man's bones, some belong to Homo erectus, Java man. All these different bony types are compared. You can't explain a human being on the basis of bones. What about a thalidomide baby born without legs? It has no leg bones. Does that mean it's not a human being? On the basis of the anatomist, yes, if parts are missing, then it's an incomplete organism. How can you explain emotions and inspirations and your own heartfelt state? How can you explain happiness and grief on the basis of bones and tissues? That's not our life. These are the mechanisms that enable life to display itself. We have to have levers, we have to have muscles, so that life can express itself. But we can't explain away life just in terms of the levers and the joints and the bones and the muscles and the nerves. These are necessary organic components that makes the unfolding of life possible. But we are more than just tissues. We are a living spirit. And if we can say to ourselves sometimes, within myself I am a spirit, and as a spirit I'm quite invisible to the sight of others. We don't see one another's spirits directly. We don't see one another's thoughts in the mind directly. You cannot look at a person and see the exact thoughts that are moving around inside. It's only from a person's facial expression that you get some sort of hint, even of their emotional state. So much that is real in an individual is invisible. Now, the funny part is, science says, well, if you can't see it, you know, it's not real. And yet no one has ever seen an electron. No one. We can photograph atoms with field ion microscopes and electron tunneling microscopes. Atoms have been photographed, but no one has ever seen an electron. Yet the electron is at the basis of the whole of physics and chemistry. Science bases itself on the invisible. Yet it says, oh, you can't believe in the invisible, it's not real. Very, very strange, contradictory situation. You see, in a certain sense, the scientist has faith in the electron. You know some of its properties. We have faith in God because we know some of the properties of God. And the first big property is the life that we experience. Secondly is the ordering of the universe. Thirdly is the infinite detail we find in living things as they interrelate to each other. Fourthly, in the ultra-fine detail within each living organism. Each organism is a universe like we are. And if we look at organisms under the microscope, and this is something Swedenborg said that people should do, get a microscope, look at insects, look at the small animalcules that you'll find in pond water. He was inviting people to have a look to see these incredibly complex worlds. He said if you have even a trace of rationality and intelligence, you will see that it's the outworkings of a creative process. Sometimes we need convincing through our senses that there is a creative process at work. Oh, it's there all right. But we mustn't hold it in the mind just as a passive belief. Just saying to ourselves, oh yes, there's a God. That means absolutely nothing. It means absolutely nothing. That's just like saying, well, I think there's a man up on the moon. It's just an abstract statement. But when we feel life flowing through us, when we see that it comes from an invisible source that it activates and motivates us, it gives us sensitivity, it gives us consciousness, then we see there is a very, very great mystery associated with it, which our external senses cannot explain. Therefore, we have to arouse our internal spiritual senses. That means getting quiet, searching inwards, exploring our internal environment. And as we explore our internal environment, we go from one state to another state. We go from our Egypt into the Sinai Desert within ourselves, and we have such desert places. We cross the River Jordan, we get into the Promised Land. That's movement into the spiritual part of ourselves. We can and must undertake many journeys of exploration within ourselves. Just as we travel the world and we visit interesting places, so we must travel on the inside and see the truly fascinating states, attitudes, experiences and sensations that are there. Spiritual states as well as physical states. The Sufis are very keen on exploring these states, and they talk about these things called hal. Now, hal is a certain state of experience you achieve after studying, shall we say, the Quran or some of the writings of Rumi or Ibn Arabi or some of these great mystics who have insight. One passes from ordinary life into a special state, and you're in that state maybe for a few days, maybe for some months, and you are expected to explore the ins and outs of that new state you've reached within yourself. It's another place inside yourself. But it would be a mistake to remain there forever. One has to move on to an even more elevated state, or hal, on the inside. This is the internal journeying which is so important for us all. When we study the movements of Paul as he moved round from Asia Minor across to Greece and over to Rome and so on, this is tracing out the same sort of thing. Paul went to one place, tarried there for 3.5 days, goes to another place, stays there for 2 days, goes on to another place and is there for a week. Why those times? Why those places? See, nothing is without significance. All those places that he visited, all the places that the Israelites moved through, they are these hal or states that we all have. We have to undertake this long journey within ourselves. But it's such a fascinating journey. Some of these states that we enter are ecstatic. They're filled with harmonies and beauties, and we feel that the whole of heavenly life has opened up for us. But then, to our disturbance, we find that we have to move on, we can't remain there, and so we get into a barren no man's land for a while, and we think, I've done something wrong, everything's faded away, I'm sinking back, it was only just an illusion. But if we persevere, we reach a better state, a better hal within ourselves. And it's different from, and it's even more remarkable in many respects, than that earlier state that we moved into. So we're going to have apparently ups and downs, highs and lows. We only get the lows when we move into these intermediate states that are only transitions. We have to be prepared for this. But all of this is part and parcel of the discovery of what I am living for. Now we have to keep putting that question to ourselves. And we shouldn't expect a fixed answer. And each time we put the question to ourselves, we're going to get a different aspect of the answer. There will always be something new. So when we say in deep, prayerful meditation, what am I living for? There's going to be a sort of a silent stirring, a felt response on the inside. We have to notice that, because the higher things can only communicate with us in the gentlest of ways. It's like a breeze or a gentle, gentle zephyr on the inside that just wafts a new meaning, a new shade of evaluation, a new touch of vision, a new sensation of something internal and very important. We have to try and grow ourselves in the direction of those gentle promptings that come to us from another level. The voice of the Spirit is very quiet. That old saying, "Be still and know that I am God," indicates that in the deepest silence and stillness that we can bring about in ourselves, something will filter through and touch us. Of course, we always expect the dramatic. We like to see or think of angels in radiant splendor appearing before us. It doesn't work like that. Otherwise, we fall into that terrible state that occurred over in the Middle East some months ago. When the Gulf War was on, there was a big conference held between Bush, Saddam Hussein, and Bob Hawke. And they were trying to work out what they were going to do with the Middle East when the war was over. What sort of stability, what new things could be introduced to restructure the whole area. And in the middle of their discussions, the Archangel Gabriel suddenly appeared with all this radiance and glory, and they were thunderstruck, especially the agnostics and the atheists who were present. And the archangel said, "The world is going to end next Tuesday. That's the end. You go back to your countries and tell people to prepare for the end." So Bush went back and told the Americans, "Well, we've done our very best, you know, but it's coming to an end. God bless America," and saluted. Saddam Hussein told his people, "Well, we tried to put on the biggest of all battles, but it is the will of God that the world will end. That's it. Farewell." Bob Hawke went back to Australia and on TV made the announcement, "Well, I did tell you that some time ago there will be no poverty for children, no children be in poverty in Australia. It won't, they won't be in poverty after next Tuesday." Now, see, that's taking the idea of an angel in a very, very literal fashion. People would love to see angels with all this glory pouring out of them. Right, that's an appearance. Some of the great visionaries and prophets of the past have seen that, but it's only a representation. An angel is also a communication. The Greek word angelos means a message or a messenger. It's a communication from God to us. It may come in a silent, secret form. That can be an angelic presence. We have to be open and alert to these whisperings of the Spirit within us, because the divine never leaves any person untouched, never leaves any person untended. Otherwise, we would drop dead instantly. The very fact that life is flowing through us shows that there is a caring presence inside. And that caring presence is constantly, ever so gently, inviting, beckoning, encouraging, and inspiring us to make something of our lives, to open that inward door, to open that outward door, and to allow something in us to become reciprocally connected with that which is flowing into us. That's what's going on all the time. But because we tend to live in this heavy outer part of ourselves, we're so involved in these interactions with the physical world around us, we don't even heed these gentle invitations on the inside. Now, this is where our being duties come into play. We must pay more attention to the possibilities that are sown into us for spiritual growth. But we must, at the same time, try and correct and line up in harmony with our inner self the things of the outer psyche. That's tidying up the little space entrusted to us. To the extent that we can do our outer work, whether it's in our home and in our workplace, well, neatly and tidily, so that correspondingly shows that we can keep the inside of us tidy. When there is harmony, then there is space for something to flow into us. If that flow can take place, higher self and lower self blend together. We become unified. With a unified being, the divine all the more tries to get us to catch the vision of what we're living for. And that's what we must struggle for all of our lives.